Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, as always, for joining our monthly BDS Live Monitor. It's a pleasure to have everybody on the line, and I thank you, as always, for joining us. This afternoon, we have the privilege to have our good friend, Professor Andrew Pessin, who is currently the campus bureau editor of the Algaminer. Professor Pessin is a professor of philosophy at Connecticut College. He has written a great deal on our issues, BDS, campus environment, and he is in the trenches, and so we are very happy to have him here with us this afternoon. He will be talking about his forthcoming volume that is entitled Totalitarians at the Gate, the BDS Assault on Free Speech and the University. We also have the privilege of having, as always, our friend Dr. Alex Jaffe, who is the editor of our BDS Monitor, who will also be with us this afternoon. So we will have a little bit of back and forth after Andrew is done talking. A few housekeeping issues, as always, for those of you who have not been able to join us in the past, but just to go over them so we know how the format will work. Professor Pessin will give his remarks. After he's done, we'll open up the floor to as many questions as we have. Vis-a-vis the actual Q&A, those of you who are logged in on the computer, you will see an icon for a hand. If you press that icon, should you have a question, I will be able to see that question, and then I'll be able to unmute you, and then you can ask your question. Those of you on the phone, you can also raise your hand, and I will hopefully be able to afford you that opportunity to ask a question as well. It has worked in the past, and I'm hoping that it will work today. If not, you can always email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And so if you have a question that you want to either will not be able to ask on the phone, you can email us, we'll read it, and you can you will be able to have your question answered. Again, if you have questions after the call, you're always welcome to email us. So that's always the case. So without further ado, I don't want to take time. Again, I will let Professor Pessin. Andrew, it's a pleasure for us to have you here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Asaf. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I really appreciate the invitation, and I particularly appreciate the support that SPME gave me at various important points. It was critical for me, and I will be eternally grateful to the organization and to Asaf for that support. I'm told I have 15 or 20 minutes to talk, and then we'll open the floor for questions or comments. I do have, I think, a lot of bad and scary things to say. I'm a pessimist by nature, but I also have some good news. I hope I'll remember to squeeze in a little bit of the good news towards the end. Let me give you a brief sort of self-introduction. I am a philosophy professor. I've done most of my scholarship on 17th century philosopher René Descartes. I'm also a novelist. My second novel, my new novel, is coming out in May called The Irrationalist, and it's based on the sad life and very mysterious death of René Descartes. And for years, I've been a rather quiet, modest Israel advocate on the side, on Facebook, never on my campus. In fact, 20-plus years of teaching in a college classroom, the words Israel and Palestine or Palestinians have never crossed my lips in the classroom or on campus, and I thought that was a good thing. Connecticut College for years was a very quiet place on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I saw no need to disrupt that. So I did my advocacy on the side, Facebook posts. And that's how things were until 2 years ago, when a post of mine from the summer of 2014, the 2014 Hamas-Israel war, a post that was defending Israel's right to nonviolently defend itself via blockade from a genocidal terrorist group, Hamas, was misinterpreted to be a racist screed against Palestinians. And by the time the dust settled, what I can say is I had a very new perspective on what was going on campuses in general. And I can say with really close to 100% conviction, I now believe that pretty much all the hostility to Israel we're seeing on campuses today just is anti-Semitism. It's Jew hatred wrapped up in a polite form, relatively polite form. It was a real eye-opening experience, and it was just like a paradigm shift to suddenly see the campus scene in general so differently. When things were particularly intense for me, the death threats were coming in, and I was moments away from a nervous breakdown, literally, something very important happened. The media got hold of the story, and I started getting emails from people around the world, from Jews around the world primarily, emails of support. And those emails were so important to me. They really took me from a place of near collapse. I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and they sort of stood me back up and made me realize that I wasn't alone and that I had thousands of virtual soldiers behind me. And what I learned from that was how important it is to communicate to individuals. If you see individuals under attack for standing up for Israel or for Jews on some campus somewhere, it's unbelievably important to reach out with an email or words of support. And when that happened to me, and this will bring me now to my book in just a moment, when that happened to me, I remembered that 6 months earlier I had read in Tablet an account by Doron Ben-Attar, a Fordham history professor, who had undergone a really unpleasant experience when he stood up for Israel on his campus. And at the time I had read it 6 months earlier and said, oh, that's really terrible, and then I moved on because that's what we do, we're all so busy. But when I realized how important it was to receive emails from people outside, 6 months later I emailed them and said, I'm so sorry it took me this long. I read about your situation. I'm on your side. Anything I can do to support you, please let me know. He wrote back immediately and said, with an idea, he said, why don't we put together a volume collecting narratives from faculty members who've essentially been harassed or intimidated or bullied for expressing pro-Israel views. And I said, oh, that sounds like fun. Why don't we do that? So we put out a call for papers, and within probably a month, we had more than 30 proposals coming in from not just the United States, but Canada, the UK, Israel, Australia, even South Africa. And we realized just how pervasive this problem is and just how almost all of these cases were entirely under the radar. People just, they weren't catching media attention. People were suffering in silence. And so we realized we had a book on our hands. That's what we've been working on over the last, it took about a year and a half. The book is now in press with Indiana University Press as part of their anti-Semitism series. We're hoping that it will come out by the end of the year. So that was one really good outcome of my own experience. It was one bit of lemonade I made out of a lemon. A second bit was in when it was all resolved, David Affune, the editor-in-chief of the Allgemeiner, which is a terrific news outlet, I'm sure most of the listeners are aware of it, that focuses on matters of concern to Jews and about Israel, reached out to me wanting to start up a campus bureau for the Allgemeiner dedicated to covering the campus scene, and I was privileged to serve as the head editor of the campus bureau, which I've been doing now for a little over a year. And in that capacity, I have been following the campus scene extremely closely, and so what I'd like to share with you is a little bit of how the campus scene looks to me and what our book is going to hopefully contribute to the discussion when it comes out. So a brief sketch of the campus scene. Many of you, I'm guessing, will be familiar with at least the basics, but we're all expecting a very big year, 2017. It's a year of big anniversaries. It's the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, the 70th anniversary of the UN Partition Resolution, biggest one, the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. So we're expecting and have already begun to see a lot of anti-Israel activity on campuses. Indeed, there are BDS campaigns sprouting up all over. I'm aware of something like 12 to 15 different campuses. Several have already had their votes, and so far I think 3 failures and for the BDS people, victories for us, and 1 victory for them, failure for us. But nevertheless, BDS is popping up in lots of places, more to come. There's been tremendous campus graffiti and vandalism. Even before the election in November, the Allgemeiner was overwhelmed with swastika reports coming from campuses. Like every week, 2 to 3 different campuses were reporting swastika graffiti. After the election, it got even crazier. But not just swastikas, those are continuing, as a matter of fact, a little bit slower pace now, but still weekly, at least one campus is getting a swastika. But we're seeing physical vandalism, mezuzot being ripped down, menorahs being vandalized. A couple weeks ago, the Chabad house at Virginia Tech, their lawn was littered with neo-Nazi leaflets, etc. In the past few years, literally dozens of talks and cultural performances have been interrupted, talks by Israelis or pro-Israel speakers being interrupted, typically led by BDS forces, typically Students for Justice in Palestine, literally dozens in the past few years, several in the past couple of weeks even. And then in the past year, there have been several, I think the right word is mob scenes, serious mob scenes where Jewish and Zionist students were essentially trapped. At King's College in London, there were a year ago, there were smashed windows, a fire alarm pulled. UC Irvine had a film showing interrupted where the students were sent watching the pro-Israel, the Israeli film were trapped in the room. And in the fall at UC London, there was a horrible scene where basically the audience members had to be rescued by the police and escorted out of a room where the mobs had trapped them. We've seen now, this is no surprise, just in the last few weeks, there have been real mob scenes on campuses against the conservative speakers in general. At Middlebury was a big one, Berkeley, Canada's Ryerson University a few weeks ago. Physical violence, smashed windows, things burned, things destroyed. You can't help but look at this and look at the trajectory and feel like serious violence is just around the corner where people are going to get hurt. There have also been, I think, several really key cases I want to just mention briefly in the past couple of months, really indicative of the general tenor of the campus. A couple of months ago at the School of Oriental and African, or is it Asian, School of Oriental and African Studies in London, which is a real central spot for anti-Israel hatred, a student resolution was passed, essentially no platforming, meaning forbidding to speak, anybody either supportive of or affiliated with Zionism. And that means no platformed, not just with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but on any subject whatsoever. And since something like 93% of British Jews suggest that they are supportive of Zionism, at least insofar as they support Israel's right to exist, that student resolution was essentially equivalent to no Jews are allowed to come speak on this campus. That's how powerful that was. I'm sure many of you followed the ups and downs and ins and outs at McGill over the last couple of months, where the student government representative tweeted, "Punch a Zionist today." And while eventually there was some backlash and he ended up having to resign his position, the scary parts were that A, that he could feel comfortable tweeting that in the first place, B, the tremendous amount of support he got within student government and from the student population at McGill, where he was seen as the victim for being criticized and attacked for advocating violence against Zionists. And indeed, another McGill student published a post on her Facebook page talking about how threatened she felt at the support this kid got on campus for advocating violence against Zionists. And then at Columbia, Ambassador Danone was giving a talk, and not only were there disruptions, but at the last minute, Columbia sort of stuck it in a private room, limited attendance, all in the name of security, of course. But this is fitting a certain pattern where pro-Israel speakers, whether for good reasons or not, I mean, security reasons are legitimate reasons, but the very fact that there are security reasons is what's problematic. Pro-Israel speakers are getting partitioned away in private audiences. It's very uncomfortable to give a big public lecture supportive of Israel or representing Israel on many, many campuses today. And lastly, I want to mention two other really important cases in the past year or so. At UT Austin, this is one of the cases that's discussed in our book, there was a major disruption. SJP disrupted in Israel lecture, and Professor Ami Petazur confronted the protesters, and eventually he was brought up on charges, even though they were the ones who had disrupted the event in a really very violent and scary way. That was a year plus ago. But then a little bit more recently in the fall, Carolyn Glick, the well-known, certainly right-leaning journalist who has published a book supporting supporting the one-state solution from the Israeli perspective. She was invited to speak at UT Austin, and at the last minute, some of the Jewish groups withdrew their support, essentially canceling her lecture at the last minute. And what was crucial here was the following. The next day, the same SJP leader who had orchestrated the disruption of Ami Pettersruer's event the year before tweeted out the following. I'm going to use a little bit of bad language. In response to the Jewish students canceling Carolyn Glick's lecture, he tweeted, "When you don't even have to mobilize to shut shit down." And to me, that's one of the most painful moments at all. When you don't even have to mobilize to shut shit down. The cumulative effect of this pressure on campus, the disruptions, the threatened violence. And when these people disrupt, it's not peaceful disruptions. They're calling for violence. They're chanting intifada. They're calling for the destruction of Israel. They're calling the speakers and audience members racist, ethnic cleansers, perpetrators of genocide. This is scary, hostile, very close to physically violent stuff. It's extremely intimidating. It's having its effect. It gets to the point where Jewish students are afraid to identify as Jews. They're certainly afraid to be Zionists on campus, where if a controversial speaker such as Carolyn Glick, who's a very bright person who has very interesting things to say and certainly deserves a voice at the table, if you ask me, you may not agree with her, but she should be a participant in the discussion. But the Jewish students are so afraid of being affiliated with anything that smacks of pro-Israel that they shut it down themselves. Self-censoring. That's the product of, you know, some years now of this intimidating atmosphere. So Daron and I, you know, we set out to focus on the personal attack. That was the original plan of the book, to collect narratives from faculty members who had been on the receiving end of anti-Israel intimidation, nastiness, bullying, etc. As I said, we immediately got well over 30 proposals within a month or 6 weeks. But as the proposals started coming in and started reading through them, we realized that dreadful as the problem already was, this problem of, you know, personal attacks, overall, the problem is even worse and bigger and, you know, more enormous. And what we began to see through these essays, and then more essays came in, of course, over the months that we were working on the book, we began to see that what was going on was really nothing less than an attack on the university, the very concept of the university, the essence of the university, that the attack, the BDS attack, is particularly focused on Israel and certainly pro-Israel Jews, but it really is an attack on the university as a whole. And so the volume, it still has a significant emphasis on personal attacks. We've got, in the end, I think, 24 faculty members and 7 students providing sort of their, talking about their experiences. And the majority of them are people who really were targeted and attacked for standing up for Israel. But they also now have a bit of a broader scope. And what we hope that the volume succeeds in doing is really demonstrating and documenting that the BDS movement, the attack on Israel, the Israel hostility, corrodes scholarship in all sorts of ways. It corrodes teaching, pedagogy, and the classroom, turning classrooms from what should be neutral spaces of learning into oppressive spaces that intimidate and silence divergent voices. The BDS movement corrodes entire departments and disciplines, diverting them from their academic missions and subject matters. It corrodes entire academic organizations, not just the ones that have already voted for BDS, such as American Studies and the National Women's Studies Association, but we now see the Middle East Studies Association just removed its non-political clause from its bylaws so that it can advocate for BDS. BDS corrodes student governments, which year after year have to divert months to a foreign policy matter concerning a conflict half a world away, rather than focus their time on students' pressing concerns. BDS corrodes civility. In fact, its proponents often explicitly reject civility as a tool of oppression. And with the rejection of civility, it corrodes community. Anti-Israel campaigns are stunningly divisive. They bring out animosity, which is just inconsistent with the proper functioning of the university. So pretty much on every level that you can imagine, the BDS attack focused on Israel is really an attack on the space, the procedures, the norms and values of the university. So Our hope is that our book shows that it shouldn't just be Jews who should be concerned about what's going on here. It should be anybody who cares really about the future of higher education, about the nature of the university, etc. You know, and it's not a surprise that in these recent weeks we've seen these serious mob scenes against these conservative speakers. You know, like they've been coming for the Jews for a while, but now it's the extremely extremist progressive left atmosphere on campuses is now really producing a lot of scary scenes, not just about Israel, but about anything that doesn't toe the political line. So I think it's a scary situation. That's my bad news. I think it's a serious situation, and I think 2017 is going to be a really hard year to get through because they're going to be very, very angry this year. I will close by just saying I do see rays of hope. I do see reason to be hopeful, especially if we can make it through 2017, after 2017. I think the tide is turning a little bit. I think the Jewish students, the Jewish organizations, the pro-Israel students and organizations have really woken up now and are tackling this with a vigor that is new. And I think there have been several even concrete things that have occurred, but I'll save those for discussion, which give us reason to hope that after 2017, maybe, just maybe, we can begin to sort of right the university again and return it to a space where, you know, obviously it's okay to criticize Israel, but there's something about the manner in which the anti-Israel movement operates, namely intimidation, suppression, dishonesty, etc. That's what's unacceptable, and my hope is after 2017, we'll be able to get the university back to at least closer to where it ought to be. So those are my remarks. I believe that was just under 20 minutes, and I'm absolutely happy to stand for questions or comments. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Andrew, for everything you do. And again, a lot of what you're talking about is part of the reason that SPME exists to begin with, and, you know, exactly. Part of the us as a community of scholars dealing with the issues. I think that, you know, it's critical for all of us to stand together. And of course, you know, we are thankful to have voices like you out there, and you're not alone. So we appreciate all you do, and we are obviously here to help. Obviously, you've raised a lot of a very good points and issues. So I am opening up the floor now officially to questions. We will go from there. So we have a few hands up, let me go down the list here. So first of all, David Narrett. Let me see if I can unmute David here. David, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Asaf.
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. The floor is yours.
Yeah. Well, I was... we all owe a great debt of gratitude to Professor Pessin, and I can't imagine the horror of what you experienced and your bravery and the importance of the book, and also that the Allgemeiner revealed something I didn't know about my own campus, the University of Texas at Arlington, where SJP students had circulated social media video praising the Holocaust and saying, burn the Jews. I have written twice to my university president about this. I have yet, by email, I have yet to receive a response. I feel I'll have to print out the letter and then send it to him directly. And I was thinking, in fact, and we're fairly safe here compared to many at elite universities. Situation California's terrible. Vassar, there's so many places that are horrible. But I was thinking of actually writing up something of a polemic in the spirit of Professor Pessin. I don't know if I because it's very, very stressful and it's tough to do. But I think there's a need to reach out. So I have two questions. One is, what do individuals think of, A, the legal strategy, to the political, because we have great friends in the U.S. Congress, and yet we seem incapable of calling upon them to at least hold an investigation of what's going on and to hear our voices. And that disturbs me. And those are the most important questions. I have a third, which is very personal. I have a young son who's 18. He's going to be entering. He's has admissions to Michigan, BU, Syracuse. Should I be worried about any one of those three schools in particular? I will hold your comments in confidence, whatever. But those are three of the ones we're trying to decide between, at least at this stage, as the letters of acceptance and the other ones that we don't like come in.
Right. Thank you so much for your question and your comments and your unwarranted praise. Believe me, anything I did really because I got so much external support from organizations, from SPME and individuals like yourself who reached out to me. Very quickly on the personal question, what I recommend, the Allgemeiner published a rather controversial list at the end of December, sort of ranking colleges as the worst colleges for Jews and better colleges. And by worst, we meant places where pro-Israel Jewish students might feel the most challenges, the most threatened, et cetera. But what I want to stress, and you can check the rankings to see where those schools lay there, but I want to stress is that's just one data point, and colleges are complicated places. And even if there's a strong anti-Israel, nasty anti-Israel movement going on campus, such as Columbia, for example, that, in my opinion, isn't reason alone not to send a kid there. In fact, many schools which have the nasty anti-Israel environment, such as Columbia, also have a very powerful pro-Israel environment as well. And plus, a number of students, especially if they maybe thrive on some conflict, end up having very meaningful experiences during college, sort of battling the anti-Israel elements. So the fact that there's anti-Israel pressure and intimidation on campus is not itself a reason not to go there. And indeed, it would be a tragedy, I think, if the Jewish community stopped sending their students to these schools, because that effectively yields the campus to the other side. So as a community, I think we want to continue to go to these schools, but you want to go prepared, knowing what you're getting into. Your child wants to know, should know what he's getting into, and should go prepared to engage. So that's what I recommend there. As far as the legal strategy, that's a fascinating and deep question. I'll just be brief about it. It clearly could be a topic for a whole seminar. The legal strategy has been growing on our side and has seen successes. I think something like 17 or 18 states now have passed anti-BDS legislation of one form or another. You've got a couple of organizations that are pursuing lawfare. So like right now, for example, the American Studies Association is being sued by several of its members for violating its bylaws and passing BDS. And the danger and what the name calling that goes on when you pursue the legal strategy is that we're violating either academic freedom or First Amendment rights. People, of course, are free to criticize Israel. They're free as individuals to boycott Israel. No one's obliged to, buy products from any place. And the other side will argue that by passing laws restricting or penalizing BDS, you're infringing on First Amendment. Those are careful things that have to be navigated very carefully. But I personally am all in favor of the legal strategy. I do believe in free speech, but I also believe that, for example, organizing boycotts on the basis of national origin is discriminatory and therefore shouldn't be allowed. I'm not a legal expert, so I can't address quite the First Amendment issues there. But the point is, the legal strategy is happening, and it has been successful. And I know that it has an effect. It does have an effect. The other side worries that it will chill free speech on campus, for example, when a state passes anti-BDS resolution. I don't believe it will chill free speech, but it will raise the bar a little bit. Those who want to criticize Israel, I think, have a higher bar of credibility that they have to pass now before they will criticize Israel. They have to be really sure of their facts, and they have to be really careful about advocating for boycotts, which may in fact be illegal in one way or another, or certainly are not endorsed by the state in which they reside. So the lawfare is happening. I'm in favor of it. It can be controversial because of free speech issues. And clearly, there's a lot more we could say on that subject. Great, thank you for that question.
All right, on to Haley. Let's see. Haley, can you hear us? Haley, can you hear us? Okay, we will try again. Try Lauren. Lauren, can you hear us?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Hi, so Professor Pessin, thank you so much for sharing with us today. So I'm a student at Kalamazoo College in Michigan, and I'm researching the prevalence of Holocaust inversion in Omar Bargoti's BDS advocacy. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that data is wanting to note the exact extent to which Holocaust inversion pervades anti-Semitic incidences on college campuses, because there's amazing organizations like AMCHA, but they're in their initial stages, and as like you said earlier in your research, when anti-Semitic incidences aren't reported, that doesn't mean they're not happening.
Right.
And so I was wondering, in your interviews and with your experience, how often you see Holocaust inversion, you know, comparing Jews to Nazis, Israel to, or Zionism to Nazism, and claiming Jews exploit the Holocaust to justify Israel in BDS in general, or like just campus anti-Semitism in particular?
Thank you so much for that question, and it's a huge question, and I can only respond sort of anecdotally, so it's, you know, hardly scientifically. What I've become very convinced of now, and in another conversation I think I could defend at length, is that I'll say 95% of anti-Israel activity on campus is Jew hatred dressed up in some relatively polite form, right? So there's no question you see, as you're calling it, Holocaust inversion. I mean, you see it everywhere. It usually is on, I would like to say, on the fringes of most campus movements, but it is there on many or most campus movements. There, I think the other side is working very hard to present their anti-Israel hostility as reasoned, scholarly, academic, respectable. They're trying very hard to follow those rules. The problem is, I believe, when you really follow those rules of pursuing agendas which are informed by scholarship, by respect for truth, etc., you wouldn't be anti-Israel, right? So like, the only way to be anti-Israel ultimately is to violate those rules. So it's sort of built in my view, built into the whole agenda, that you're not going to be following those rules very closely. But they're trying hard. They're trying hard to be respectable. But what happens is there's always, and this will vary from campus to campus, and I don't know anything in particular about Kalamazoo, but depending who's running the movement, right? So in some schools, it's actually Jewish students who are at the center of SJP and running the movement. But in other schools, it might be literally Islamist students, not just Muslim students, but students who are supportive of Islamism, you know, as a political ideology, etc. Some schools have those as well. Depending who's at the lead, you can get more or less of the really, really nasty language like Holocaust inversion, comparing Jews to Nazis, etc. And what's starting to happen is this is getting exposed thanks to, I believe they deserve credit, but they're controversial, the Canary Mission. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Yeah. But Canary Mission is this, it's run anonymously. Nobody knows who runs this group. But they're basically, the critics call them, you know, McCarthyite blacklisters. But what they're doing is, they are a watchdog for what students and faculty members are saying and doing on campuses. And they, the previous caller mentioned how University of Texas Arlington SJP, basically was putting out social media supporting burning the Jews, right? Canary Mission actually discovered that. And they're finding on campus after campus, they keep exposing pockets of students who are not afraid to say on social media, this is public, right? This is not even, who knows what they're saying amongst themselves. They're not afraid to say on social media horrible things like kill the Jews, burn the Jews, Hitler didn't finish the job, etc. So if you go to the Canary Mission website, you will discover it's scary how prevalent it is, right? It's scary how prevalent it is, how comfortable so many students are at so many campuses, including University of Texas Arlington, who knew in advance, right? Putting this stuff up on social media. So anecdotally, to summarize, what I would say is it's everywhere, but it tends to be in the fringes and on the peripheries of the campus movements. but Canary Mission is exposing more and more of them. So, you know, I don't know what the future will hold there, but I think the backlash is growing to the extreme rhetoric. This is my little ray of hope. So that after 2017, I think we're going to see less of it. That's I'm going to go on the record as sort of predicting that. they're going to play by the rules of the university and normal moral rules a little bit better after 2017 because the pushback has begun. So to summarize, it's definitely there. It's worrisome, but hopefully it's being exposed and people are rejecting it. So hopefully it will diminish.
Great.
So I hope that was useful.
Thank you. Thank you, Lauren. Okay, we're going down the list here. Excuse me for mispronouncing or the name, but Sarah Dean is our next caller here. Let's see. Sarah Dean, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Please call me Dean.
Sorry, if I botched your name, I apologize, but go ahead, Dean.
No worries. So I actually have two questions. The first at the
institution. Who you are, you know, student, faculty?
Oh, sorry. I am used to be a faculty member at a small liberal arts college in Minnesota.
Okay.
What I experienced at that institution is that a lot of the anti-Israel activity is really centered in two places. One is in the basically the quote-unquote diversity crowd in the institution that is basically preaching a message of anti-whiteness, and Jews are not considered white apparently, but that this is also very much supported from within the institution itself, from faculty, from high-powered donors, and so forth. And my question is, particularly as states begin to pass anti-BDS laws and so forth, what is the mechanism basically to turn these institutions in and have them sanctioned?
Andrew?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for that. I'm just quickly jotting it down so I don't forget it. So I think you're absolutely right. First of all, seeing the anti-Israel movement centered the diversity crowd, you know, I have certainly noticed, I have in my notes at least 6 or 7 different institutions where that institution's Office of Diversity, Inclusion, Equality, Tolerance, there's a whole bunch of names that often go together, but, and they're sprouting up all over these sorts of offices as administrations all over the place. At least 6 or 7 different places where that office was sort of ground zero for the anti-Israel hostility. So you're absolutely onto something, and not too many people have written about this as far as I know, but it's absolutely something that's worth exploring and studying. And you're also right that a crucial part of it is, it's, you know, a lot of it is the anti-whiteness, right? So the progressive left, that's the fundamental thing, anti-whiteness, and whiteness, I think, is a catchword for privilege in general. And so Jews, whether they're typically seen as white, certainly in North America, and they're certainly seen as privileged, you know, on these campuses, so they automatically fall into the wrong side of that divide. So a good chunk of it, I do think, comes from there. You're absolutely right. As far as the mechanisms, what I think we're seeing is most institutions, in the name of free speech, have been erring on the wrong side, I believe, of enabling activities which violate academic norms and attack Israel, right? But in the name of free speech, they want to stay out of it as much as they can. But what they end up doing is actually empowering and enabling. Rather than really staying neutral, they tend to empower and enable, and that's problematic. They will typically, I was actually quite stunned when the earlier caller mentioned that the president didn't respond to his 2 emails, because they have a boilerplate that they send out whenever there's an incident on their campus, reaffirming their, you know, their commitment to free speech, etc., but also recognizing certain things cross a line. So they send out this boilerplate, but they do very little, and I think they're afraid to do. They don't know what to do. But here's a suggestion I have. I don't know that you'll ever get to a point. Well, that's wrong. So you're seeing some cases. So in New York, for example, the New York State Legislature last year threatened to withhold funding from CUNY, the City University of New York, which is a public institution funded by the New York State Legislature. They threatened to withhold funding unless CUNY cleaned up its act with respect to anti-Semitism. You might remember the Zionist organization submitted a long legal complaint to CUNY documenting all sorts of incidents of anti-Semitic incidents on a number of its campuses. So, you know, you had the New York State Legislature stepping in there, you know, putting money on the or taking money off the table more accurately to bring about its result. The anti-BDS legislation that we're seeing, I'm no legal expert, but as far as I can tell, I think all of it takes the form of, or some variation on the following, where a state is committing itself to, let's say, not investing in organizations that support BDS. Like they're going to use their pension funds, for example, and not, and they won't direct them to any BDS supporting places. That is a far cry from, you know, challenging what goes on campuses, right? That's one of the reasons why they're not chilling free speech. They're not penalizing anybody. They're just refusing to reward people who support BDS. Except for the New York case, I'm not aware of a case where a state legislature, let's say, is trying to sort of legally sanction even the public universities. Something similar sort of brewing in California. The regents have passed a document. I don't want to get distracted onto that, but it's hard to imagine closing that gap, imagining that legislatures will really start, I don't know, putting sanctions on their public universities over the Israel matter. There'd be so much backlash, it would be hard to do politically, I think. But here's a positive response. There's a new organization, relatively new in the last couple of years, Alums for Campus Fairness. So if you Google them, you'll find them, Alums for Campus Fairness. They started basically at Vassar and at Oberlin, and it was a group of alumni just starting to feel really disgusted at what they were seeing going on campuses, specifically with respect to Israel and Jews. It's now a thing. There's actually, I think they've got a couple of dozen chapters. Several of the chapters are really big and organized and have now concrete accomplishments to their name, including at Columbia University. There's now a very significant chapter there. Alums for Campus Fairness is a new idea, and it's a great idea, because if you can mobilize alumni to weigh in, not just one at a time, but en masse, and alumni, as we all know, are, you know, major sources of funds for institutions, and alumni, by and large, demographically, are going to be far more supportive of Israel and of the way the university should be, and namely a neutral space for the free exchange, even of controversial ideas. Alumni are much more committed to that than current students, who are much more driven by the agenda. So if we can mobilize alumni in this way, I think that has a promise of being a really effective way of at least pushing administrations to do the right thing from our perspective. And so I urge folks out there to check out Alums for Campus Fairness, join the chapter for your alma mater, whatever it might be, or start one if there isn't one, and I think that has promise. So that would be a medium-sized answer to your very excellent question, for which I thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just weigh in on
one or two of those points? Yeah, go ahead.
Right. With respect to the legal aspect of this, and again, I'm not a lawyer either. Andrew's right that most state legislation addressing BDS has to do with corporate investment on the part of state entities like pension funds. There are a couple of cases, most recently in South Carolina, where the states are, and also I think in Texas, where the states are working on legislation condemning anti-Semitism using the language from which has now been adopted by the U.S. State Department, which includes demonization, delegitimization of Israel as a core element defining anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And this hasn't played out in court yet, but the other side, which again has become extremely organized from its legal standpoint as well, has been extremely vocal in objecting to this legislation, and specifically the inclusion of any language related to Israel, as a profound infringement, in their view, on free speech. Now, how any of this is going to play out in court, where I expect it will be in a few years, I can't really say. But to this point, it has had no effect on the ground game, on or off campus, and I personally don't expect that it really will. I expect that the other side will welcome a court battle, expecting that these kinds of provisions, this kind of language, will be struck down, and that they will be provided both on and off campus with a completely open field to pursue their agenda in the same language that they have been all along.
Yeah. So let me just, may I add one more point to that? One of the little rays of hope that I, you know, made reference to is that the International Holocaust Remembrance Committee's definition of anti-Semitism, a European thing, which is basically very similar to the State Department in defining certain types of Israel criticism as anti-Semitic. As you know, the UK, it's adopted from this commission that had something like 37 different countries, European countries, I believe, representing it. But the UK officially adopted it, I believe, in November or December. And as an immediate consequence of this definition, where demonizing and delegitimizing Israel count as anti-Semitic, just this past couple of months at three different UK universities where Israeli apartheid week events were going on, there were cancellations by the administrations of several of these events on the basis of that definition. So it was, now this is not a court situation, but you know, and then the Columbia chapter of Alums for Campus Fairness, inspired by what they saw going on at UK, tried to do the same thing at Columbia. One of the events at Apartheid Week at Columbia this year, a few weeks ago, was an event defending Zionism equals racism, to refer back to the infamous UN resolution. And the ACF chapter at Columbia really lobbied very hard. They lobbied the administration hard. They went public of saying, well, by the State Department's definition, this is anti-Semitic, and what university wants to be behind an anti-Semitic act? They failed here. They didn't stop that act. But this is it gives a new tool. Even if it's not legal, the fact that some legally relevant organizations, such as the State Department, or now the UK has adopted it, Prime Minister May as her official definition, once you've got a label, you've got a lever to put some pressure on administrations even before it gets into the courts. And, you know, so there's a ray of hope there that if it's acknowledged by enough people that attacking Israel in this way, demonizing, delegitimizing, is anti-Semitic, then we have something with which to pressure at least administrations.
Great. Thank you both. We have a few more questions, so let me try to, in the time that we have left. David Slutsky, another David. David, are you here? Can you hear us? David?
Yes. Do you hear me?
Well, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I'm actually a middle school teacher, and I'm afraid of this whole movement trickling down. I try to teach about noticing bias and things like that. So I just wanted to get Professor Pessin's view on, you know, how we can definitely get the word out to high schools and even below.
That's a great question. Thank you for that. I don't know. I know little about pedagogy at lower levels, so I wouldn't speculate much. But there's no question that the other side is trying to trickle this down. There was a notorious event. Was it 2 years ago already? In Ithaca, where basically the other side brought into a third grade classroom some Palestinian activists and like tried to get all the kids excited about, can't remember the exact language, but it was bad. It was become freedom fighters for Palestine or something like that. It was just so incredibly inappropriate. And fortunately, video emerged of the event, and there were some ramifications later. But it's clear that they're trying to trickle it down as far as, as far as they can. There have been efforts, I know, to rewrite at least high school and I think even middle school curricula and textbooks to tell, the pro-Palestinian narrative, let's say, rather than a neutral narrative or certainly a pro-Israel narrative. So the effort is absolutely there on the other side. I don't know. I guess I don't have anything substantive to say about what to do about that other than to fight it every time it appears. I personally My kids go to a Jewish school. I want to develop a love of Israel for them, but I am a scholarly academic person, I believe, with certain integrity. And, you know, every time I say something nice about Israel, I'm very aware. I don't want to just brainwash them. I support Israel because I've studied the issues at some length, and I've formed an opinion, a reasoned opinion that I can back up to the degree that I'm capable with argument and evidence, etc. You know, ultimately, I want my kids to support Israel because they reach the same conclusions I do by evaluating all the evidence, not just support Israel, you know, in a blanket brainwash sort of way. But they're kids. I mean, my 10 years old, 11 years old. So I don't exactly know what's appropriate. But, you know, I do know that there's something really horrible about brainwashing children and exposing them to one-sided narratives that are just not good or fair. And I'm hesitant to even do it, you know, on the pro-Israel side with my kids, because I know that's wrong, but so I mostly stay neutral. I stay out of it. That's my personal thing, because I don't know what to say to a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old beyond a few sentences. And I share with my rising middle schooler, you know, there's a lot of people who are really critical of Israel, and that's about all he knows. I think that's developmentally appropriate based on my experience. I don't know. So I guess I don't have a good answer to your question, but what's so important about what you're raising is this is a new front. There's everywhere we turn, there's another front for this battle to win the hearts and minds. And the other side absolutely is getting into the schools as early as third grade, which is just so repulsive to my mind. And we need to be alert to that, and we need to do our best to make sure that textbooks and curricula are fair, you know, not one-sided, but fair. How to do that, I leave up to experts such as yourself and teachers who obviously have experience in those classrooms. Thank you so much for that.
Can I just add something? Yeah, this is a huge, huge problem that is very much under the radar. And it's a very old problem, and it has a couple of different sources. For the BDS movement specifically trying to get into middle schools, primary schools, that's relatively new in the last couple of years. And you mentioned the Ithaca Elementary School incident, and that's really the tip of the iceberg. Asaf and I have written extensively about the network of Quaker schools in this.
Oh, that's right.
And we get calls frequently from parents in Quaker schools and Quaker middle schools, especially high schools, saying, my kid's teacher is doing this, they're having this kind of program, blatantly supporting BDS or an Islamist perspective. What do we do? In the public high schools, this is also a growing problem. But there's also another source that has to be mentioned in this, which is a much older and I think much more pernicious source, because it masquerades as neutral, and that's Middle Eastern Studies Centers, federally supported Middle Eastern Studies Centers at a variety of universities that are supported under the Higher Education Act, which have over the last two generations turned into very important nodes for anti-Israel education and agitation, and for Islamist agitation and really support of the Islamist narrative. And if you look at the kinds of educational materials that come out of places like Harvard or the University of Chicago or UCLA from their Middle East Studies centers, these are all resolutely negative about Israel, or they ignore Israel completely from the modern Middle East. They completely gloss over the history of Jews in the Middle East as a whole, and they are gloriously enthusiastic about Palestinians and about traditional Sunni Islam as a whole. And this is what goes out to support And they run programs for teachers, they provide materials for teachers, summer institutes, all this kind of stuff. And it's a gigantic problem. And as someone, Asaf and I, for the last 10 or 15 years have been involved with efforts to push back against these institutions to the point of looking at defunding them. And when you talk about defunding a higher education, any part of higher education, people become hysterical because somebody's ox is going to be gored and you're automatically accused of being of trying to dumb down America, and you're obviously a racist. And this is what we're up against. And my suggestion for teachers is examine very closely where your materials are coming from. And the same absolutely goes for parents. Look over your kids' shoulders when they do homework. And if they're doing something, they're doing homework from something called the Arab World Studies workbook, then you should become incensed, because it was only recently that the claims that, you know, that Muslims discovered North America and that Columbus was a Muslim or something were removed from these, from that particular source. And only through eternal vigilance, only through getting up and going ballistic at school board meetings and on your kids' principals will these things change. And ultimately, I think a real discussion has to be had about the role of higher education in shaping lower education, and the role of federal funding in all of this.
Yeah.
So.
Great. Thank you both.
Thank you for that, Alex. That was chilling. Thank you, Alex. I was trying to end on a ray of hope. That was very sobering.
Well, if you're sober now, you can wait until 4 or maybe 5 o'clock and then take care of that problem.
I will.
And even here of late, in Pennsylvania, we've been where the Quaker schools are thriving. We've had a situation where directly a link for a between a an actual pro-BDS SJP activist who's now a professor at Swarthmore, who was brought in directly into a Quaker school and in Pennsylvania, and all of that has begun the conversation. Again, it caused a great deal of problems when Jewish parents began to question what's going on, where is the disconnect between our Jewish kids and Quaker values. And again, it's an ongoing problem, which of course relates to the extensive research that Alex and I have done over the years. And so this is indeed something that we should be looking at, especially in the Quaker schools and in their high schools. I know our time is just about to end, so I want to try to keep us on time. I have there is a question that came in on the through the email, so let me read that and let me make that the last question. And we'll try to be brief on that. Obviously, there's no brief answers always, but let me try to read this to you from one of our listeners, Deborah Glazer, where she writes, "I've been an observer of the UC Irvine situation since early 2000, where my husband is a professor of economics. One of the major impediments to achieving success in our local community has been the position of the local federation, which claims to speak for the entire Jewish community. Federation historically has tried to minimize the problem, to work with the UC administration behind the scenes," those are in quotations, "to say it only happens 1 week a year and it's not really a big deal. The local Chabad also does not relish the involvement of political battles, seeing its role as purely religious and spiritual. But because of these weak responses, individuals and organizations who try to take more of an activist response are ignored or shunned as outside agitators." And so the question is, what can we do about the situation? And so if either of you have any insights, that'll be our last question.
So, listener raises is just devastating. There's a quote in the Talmud at one point. It says, like, in the days before the Messiah comes, your enemies will be in your own household. And that's how I often feel that our worst and most challenging enemies are the Jewish community itself, whether it's the many students on campus who are leading the anti-Israel charge or whether it's local federations. I mean, the problem this caller mentions is not isolated to UC Irvine. Hillel as an organization, I mean, I feel a little bad for them. They have a tremendously challenging situation that they're in. Hillel wants to be a place for all Jews, but Jews are divided amongst themselves. So what stand does Hillel take on this? And, you know, there's, as we go from campus to campus and incident to incident, there are places where I feel very critical of the Hillels on those places, but I also recognize, you know, they're supposed to represent even the Jewish students who hate Israel. So they're in a tight spot, and communities are in a tight spot for the same reason. So I don't have a practical solution other than we have to revamp our approach to education from kindergarten upwards so that we produce Jews who are not susceptible to external pressures and turn into Israel haters. And that's obviously beyond my ken to spell that out in any detail. But by the time many Jewish students get to college, the battle is lost. If they don't feel that strong sense of Jewish identity and therefore a sense of solidarity or identity with Israel, there's very little that one can do at that stage, I believe. So the problem goes all the way back into, you know, connects to our earlier conversation about education and family values and American Jews' commitment to being Jewish, which is enormous, enormous thing. So I don't have a practical solution, but I do believe that those of us who are more comfortable speaking openly and unabashedly and not embarrassed in support of Israel need to do that, because the more of us who are unabashed in our support of Israel, and that doesn't mean you can't be, you know, nuanced and rational and critical even, but you have to be unabashed in your support. You can't be embarrassed by being a Zionist. The more of us that are out there doing that, the easier it is for those who are, you know, one step in, one step out to feel comfortable being public and supportive of Israel and so forth. So revamp the entire education system and the system of American Judaism and then be unabashed. Those are my two very sort of abstract suggestions to that very, very difficult problem.
Great. Alex, do you want to say one word or two on that matter as well before we wrap up?
Yeah, I'm trying to formulate my thoughts so as not to sound too cynical. I think ultimately people are going to be confronted with the situation and will have to make choices. And that's just how anti-Semitism works, that you have to make, sooner or later it will confront you and you have to make a choice. This makes it very, very difficult for institutions which want either honestly or dishonestly to be broadly inclusive. Ultimately, you're going to have to make a choice. And when you make certain kinds of choices, you will be accused of being racist and exclusionary and elitist and so on. And it's a very difficult situation for the leaders of institution. I was down at the AIPAC meeting earlier this week, and we saw this played out very clearly. And it's the challenge for AIPAC is probably as big as it is for Hillel's. But sooner or later, I think lines have to be drawn, and the other side, and including Jews who are effectively on the other side, are very adept at using rhetoric to disparage the act of drawing lines and making choices through accusations and through this idea that unity has to be the ultimate goal, that if one claims to speak for the community, one has to include people who are in effect against the community. And I don't know that that's, I don't think that that's the case. I think reality makes it clear that at the end of the day, and whenever the end of the day is, and it hopefully is not soon, you have to choose whether you're going to side with people who want to destroy other Jews, destroy Jewish sovereignty and Jewish unity, and or side with people who want to defend that, Jews and others. So it's a big problem. It's a perpetual problem, and it's not going to go away or be resolved soon.
Great. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Andrew, for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. Thank you, of course, everybody who attended our BDS monthly call. We apologize if we did not get to your question. We will be happy to answer questions should you have further questions. If you email them to us at bdsmonitor@spme.org, again, bdsmonitor@spme.org, we will happily answer them over email. And if there are other questions for Professor Pessin, we will also, of course, happily pass them along to him as well. Please join us again next month. We will send out another notice about it in advance of the Passover holiday for all of those who are celebrating. Let me wish you a happy Passover. And thank you again for joining us. And, of course, we are here to deal with these issues and answer questions and strategize. We appreciate your help. And we're here to tackle these matters. As we can, of course, see from all our conversations, these are very complex matters that require a great deal of understanding, and we bring in part of that to the conversation so we can help all of you out there, and of course, our role in SPME to help deal and tackle many of these matters. So thank you all very much. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Alex. And have a good day.
Thank you, everybody. It was a pleasure to be here.